Okay, so this week we are in Parshat Yitro. Argument's sake, one can say that until this point, this is the most important parsha. Of course, you can argue with this. It all depends on what one's focus is. The reason why one could put forth an argument that this is the most important parsha is because over here we finally get the Aseret HaDibrot, we finally get the Ten Commandments, which means that if part of what the Torah is to give us law, yeah, we had a couple of random laws along the way. Along the way, again, there were things here and there, but now is where the law really begins. But I do want to explore a question which I think is a fundamental question, and I'm not convinced it's so easily answered. And that is when we think about what takes place at Sinai, which we can call in English Revelation at Sinai. In Hebrew, the way to call that would be Ma'amad Har Sinai. Ma'amad Har Sinai would be the Sinai event. A Ma'amad is an event. Ma'amad Har Sinai. Revelation is a much stronger word than just event. Revelation, probably in Hebrew, modern Hebrew, would be a Hitgalut, would be that God revealed himself. Hitgalut at Har Sinai, which would sort of like, if you can imagine your heads, it's like a symphony and a theological symphony. Revelation, this mass, big sound and light revelation at Sinai. So here's the first question that I want to ask. I'm not so sure how much we can get away from it. The question is, what's the more important part at Har Sinai? Is it that God spoke to man, or is it what God said to man? Which means, is it the very fact that God spoke which is important, or is it the content of what God said which is important? And one really easy way to try to break this down would be, well, what if God appeared and didn't say anything on the one hand, or what if somebody else comes and said, okay, here are some things that, are important? Which means, what is the value of the content without the revelation? And for that matter, what's the value of the revelation without the content? And my really strong suspicion is that most of you would agree with me that when you think about it in this way, in the way that I just now phrased it, that the more important element is not actually the, shall we say, the content, even though before I asked the question, if I would have said, what's the important thing at Sinai, you would say that God gave us Torah, right? We received Torah from Sinai. That's what's important. But now again, when I'm breaking it down, what's more important? The things which God said to us, or is it the very fact that God spoke, or God revealed, or God something? You can imagine whatever that something may be, and that's really what ultimately intrigues me over here. So let's start this all over again. From the creation of the world until the standing at Sinai, and by the way, for that matter, from the standing at Sinai, moving forward from that point, I would presume that this type of an event is an unparalleled event. That somehow the heavens open up, and somehow, and by the way, this is particularly difficult, somehow a being which is not a being, a God which is transcendent, a God which occupies no time and no space, no matter, somehow appears at Mount Sinai. And by the way, the more you think about what I'm presenting right now, the more you should realize that to a very great extent, the experience of Moshe by the burning bush is a microcosm of whatever is going to take place right now at Sinai. And the reason it's a microcosm is for it's a couple of levels. The first level is it's the same place. It's the exact same place. There you have a burning bush, and Moshe says, looks at it, says, wow, that doesn't make any sense. How can a bush not be consumed when it's being burned? And if you realize what he's seeing over here, and I'm saying this on a thematic level and on a representative level, means like a mashal, he's seeing something which is impossible. He's seeing something actually which is transcendent, something which is physical, but in no way is being consumed, or something which is infinite. Which means the normal way a world works, one of the basic things that you have in the world is you have fire. And what does fire do? Fire consumes something. So how can you have a fire which doesn't consume? How you can have a fire which isn't being used up? How do you have energy which somehow is keeps on being replenished? Which means I'm saying on a really basic level, but maybe that's as far as we can think this through, that is a representative or representation of transcendence, something which is there, which is no, I mean, the normal way of the world, I don't want to depress anybody, but everything deteriorates along the way. That's what we do. From the day that we were born, we were in the process of dying. I'm, again, very sorry for saying that. Okay, so that's what we are. We have to live life to the fullest and be happy and don't get depressed about the fact that every historically just about 99.9% of the people in the history of the world who weren't born died eventually, and the other ones most likely this is going to happen as well. But the thing is that all resources get used up. By the way, there's only one resource which is probably the most important natural resource in the world, that the more you use it, the more that you have it. Instead of it disappearing, the more that it grows, and that's love. The greatest natural resource is love, because the more you share, the more there is of it, and I would say any other resource, as you use it, it gets used up. But it's interesting because we're very careful about, I'm saying on an emotional level, we're very careful about sharing our love because we're very scared of it being manipulated or hurt or lost or so on. But as I said, it's the one thing that the more that we share, the more that there is of it, which is just, again, something which I think is worthwhile contemplating. And maybe basically when someone says, oh, God is love, which sounds almost silly and, you know, maybe can work on a t-shirt, but there is something to that, because love really can be transcendent. And therefore, anything which could be transcendent, maybe it does point towards a relationship with God. Moving back to the burning bush now. At the burning bush, Moshe gets his mandate. At the burning bush, God speaks to him. At the burning bush, he tells him what to do. But it's really interesting, because if I said that the burning bush is a microcosm of what's going to take place at Sinai, do you know what's lacking at the burning bush? Okay, I'll tell you. What's lacking is there's no commandments. There's no commandments at all. I mean, you're going to say that was a commandment to go and bring the Jews out of Egypt? That wasn't a commandment. That was an instruction. It's very, very different. It's much more of what I would say, it's a historical event which needs to take place, but it's not a law. It's not like God says, you know, honor your parents. Okay, that's a law. That's not what takes place over here. And therefore, when you really then come to this realization that what happened at the burning bush is the microcosm of the event at Sinai, then you realize that maybe the event at Sinai was never really about the law, but it was really about something else. Okay, so that's really point number one. Now, one of the funny things that we say when we get to Pesach night, this is someplace between the first cup of wine and the second cup of wine, so there's a chance that you'll remember this, and that is we get to the whole song Dayenu. One of the things about Dayenu is we say that had we got to Har Sinai and not received the Torah, it would have been enough. So what exactly does that mean if we got to Har Sinai and didn't receive the Torah? What is the value of being at Har Sinai not receiving the Torah? Now, if this were a different discussion right now, I would be very tempted to say that maybe at Har Sinai we felt the sense of unity, of brotherhood. I don't want to go there now. I think that's a valid approach, but I don't want to go there right now. I think that there maybe what that Dayenu is about is being at Har Sinai without receiving the Torah, but with receiving something else, and that is the very fact that God spoke. Again, I want to remind you something that we saw last week. When we're told, Vayhi b'shalach ha'am, and God sends the people, but doesn't let them go derech eretz plishtim, and instead he takes them inward. Of course he had to take them that way. Why? Because he said to Moshe at the burning bush, when you take the people out, you will serve me on this mountain. So the only way you can serve me on this mountain is by taking them back to this mountain. So it actually points out to something else, which maybe I'll say again later on in the year, but at least I'll say it now, so it'll at least maybe land someplace. The holiday of Shavuot has a dual identity to it. One of the Dvar Torahs, that's a terrible word to say in English, one of the Dvar Torah that people somehow always say on Shavuot, which is like the silliest thing in the world, is they say that, oh, Shavuot has no mitzvot, which means a very superficial analysis of Shavuot would be, oh, look, Sukkot, you sit in a sukkah. Sukkot, you take the lulav etrog and so on. On Pesach, you eat matzah. On Pesach, you talk about leaving Egypt. But Shavuot has no mitzvot to do. There's no mitzvot to do, and therefore Shavuot is just about, and now you can finish whatever your Dvar Torah you want to be. Now that's a great Dvar Torah, except for one problem. that in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, there was an agricultural side of the holiday, and you take the Bikurim, you take the first fruits, and you bring them to Jerusalem, and you celebrate the first fruits in Jerusalem. So I just want to pause there for a second. That means the holiday Shavuot is a holiday about entering into the land of Israel. The first fruits is the first tangible thing you can say thank you for, which means it's a holiday of the land of Israel. So maybe the fact that it's a Zionist holiday is why so many people forgot about it and think that there's nothing to it. Well, there's a second part of Shavuot, and that's the thing that people like to focus on, and that is that God gave us the Torah. Because if you sit and do the math, then you'll come to this quick realization that the day that the Jews receive the Torah is also Shavuot. It's, you know, you do the math, and you realize that 50 days after the Jews leave Egypt, that's when Matan Torah takes place. So the truth is that leaving Egypt, we always had two destinations. That's what I wanted to focus on. We have a dual destination. And I'm going to explain to you why I think this point is so important, because it'll go down to the very essence of who we are. There has been this argument going on for who knows how long. Or is Judaism a religion or is it a nation? You know, what are we? So obviously someone who's completely, completely non-religious is going to have a hard time saying we are a religion. It's also interesting that if somebody is a non-practicing, a non-believing Protestant, then they are not a Protestant, or a Catholic, or Episcopalian, and you keep on going down the line. But it's very funny that somebody can say, I'm a non-believing, non-practicing, proud Jew. Which means, how are you a proud Jew if you're non-believing, non-practicing? Which means, what is this element that you feel connected to? And the answer is that we are both a religion and we are a nation. What makes a nation? Well, part of what makes a nation is a land. And now, I fully apologize for any Zionist implications of what I'm saying right now, but apparently there are Zionist implications. Part of what makes us a nation is the fact that we had a homeland, we have a homeland, and all the time in between, we pined for this homeland, and we dreamed of this homeland, and we prayed toward this homeland, and we begged to receive this homeland again. Which means when now you think about leaving Egypt, there's a dual destination. The dual destination is one, to go to Mount Sinai, and the other destination is to go to the land of Israel. And the holiday of Shavuot celebrates both. It celebrates receiving the Torah at Sinai, and it celebrates the entering into the land of Israel. Now, both of those points are somehow interwoven and intertwined, because ultimately, I think the message that God is giving us when you ask that question, so what am I? I am as a Jew. Is it part of a nation, or is it a religion? Well, you're allowed to have a dual existence. That doesn't mean that there's confusion or schizophrenia. Okay? Here's a secret for you. I am a husband. I'm also a father. I'm also a grandfather. Okay? Are all of those things, you know, contradictory? Well, make up your mind. Who are you? Some of you actually may say, well, what are you talking about? You're a rabbi. Okay. So does that mean that I'm completely schizophrenic? So I don't know who I am? I don't know if I'm a rabbi, if I'm a husband, I don't know if I'm a father, if I'm a grandfather. Well, the answer is that we are able to have multiple relationships because we have multiple identities, but multiple identities does not make you, as an individual, a schizophrenic. What it makes you, or psychotic, what it makes you is somebody who has an enchanted life. Because part of having an enchanted life is having a multidimensional life. Having a lots of different things which keep you alive and keep you busy and keep you vibrant. And therefore, these things are not contradictory. My grandchildren who happen to have gone back to America recently, my son works in Princeton, and so they had to call me and FaceTime me yesterday and show me how they're diving into the snow. They're Israeli kids. What do they know about snow? And the feeling of a grandfather, you know, talking to little grandchildren is very, very different from a parent. It's just a completely different relationship. And the relationship of the kids towards a grandparent is different. But that's not the indication of confusion. It's the indication, I'm going to say it again, of a life which is enchanted. So now I go back to this point. The Jewish people have two destinies and they have dual places they need to go. But apparently we need both of them together, which means the dream is not, and I'll say this all over again, had God spoke to Moshe at the burning bush and said to him, take the Jews out and bring them to the land of Israel, I could have made a really strong argument for secular Zionism, right? Go and bring them out. Okay, it's all about liberation. It's all about being free, but that's not the story. The story is God says to Moshe, now go to Egypt and you're going to take them out. But when you take them out, you can take them to the land of Israel. But here again is the dual destiny. You are going to take them first to this mountain. And now something's going to take place on the mountain, which now brings us up to what we're up to in this week's parsha, which means this is the stopover, which we didn't necessarily realize was necessary in order to go into the land and become, and again, here's the important point, what actually is the Zionist dream? Is it, like some secular Zionist said, to be a nation like every other nation? Or is it a dream to become a nation unlike every other nation? Now, the truth is, none of us want to be different. You don't want to be different. You want to be like all the other people. Right? You want to be like all the other kids. You want to be maybe even one of the cool kids. You don't like to be different. But what could we do? That's our destiny. Our destiny is not to be a nation like all the other nations. And I'll say it again. The secular Zionist dream was one of the most unfortunate statements. I don't know if you ever heard it. Was a fellow named Gordon. This is one of the most unfortunate statements of secular Zionism. And he said that we will become a nation like every other nation when you have a Jewish police arresting Jewish men who are frequenting Jewish prostitutes. That's the Zionist dream. So excuse me, that is not the Zionist dream. The Zionist dream is when you don't need a police department, because who would even imagine stealing from one another? The dream is not to be a nation like every other nation. The dream is to be a nation unlike every other nation. But the only way we can become a nation unlike any other nation is if we make this stopover, and that stopover takes place in Sinai. Now I want to go back to the question which I raised in the very beginning. And that question was this issue, which I'll call an issue of, how should we put this, of what is the goal of what happens at Mount Sinai. And again, I'm giving you a dichotomy, so I apologize. Because one dichotomy was land of Israel or Mount Sinai? And the answer is both. Again, same question as before. What are you, right? One day, are you a mother or are you a wife? Hopefully, both. Are you a father or, right? Are you a son or are you a father? What are you? Ultimately, both. Which means a lot of our relationships don't have to be contradictory relationships. So therefore, Mount Sinai and the land of Israel, both are destinies and destinations. Full stop. At Mount Sinai, a second dichotomy. What is the main issue? Is the main issue the revelation, or is the main issue the content of the revelation? So keeping that in mind, we can now start to read, and I think that the answer, the very fact that God speaks, and again, believe me, I am not belittling the content of Torah. I'm not saying, oh, Torah, that's not important. It's the very fact that God... No, but the authority makes a difference, because it makes a really big difference if some, well, I don't want to say, if Moshe is a really smart guy and made it up, it's not the same as if God actually said it. Because one becomes really, really perhaps pragmatic, because he's a smart guy, and the other becomes something which is divine. And to touch the divine is something which is apparently it's crucial. So let's look now, and we're going to notice, hopefully, something in the very beginning of the way the Ten Commandments are described, and the revelation is described, which I think is going to answer our question immediately. So the introduction to it is this is chapter 20, verse 1. Vayedaber Elokim et kol hadvarim ha'eleh lemor. And God said all of these things, saying, now, I hope you realize there are too many words in this verse. You know, one of the things, if any of you really learn how to write properly, one of the things that you'll learn is when you have too few words in a sentence and when you have too many words. Good editing actually requires you to do both. One is to make sure that you did not just let your own imagination fill in the spaces, because sometimes you know what you want to say, but it's not there on the paper. So therefore, you need to add in qualifiers and explain exactly what you're thinking. But the other problem is that once you've qualified and explained everything, did you use too many words to do it? So it's not just part of good writing. It's actually part of good learning. And because whenever you can say something in less words, there's no reason to say it in more words. If I needed to reduce this verse into much less, I could have said Vayidaber Elokim, Anochi, right? I didn't need anything else. And God said Anochi. Why do I need anything else? But instead, Vayidaber Elokim et, and who in the world knows what the word et means? Vayidaber Elokim et kol, all hadvarim. Now, what do you need the word kol for? Vayidaber Elokim et hadvarim ha'ele. Vayidaber Elokim et kol hadvarim ha'ele lemar. So I'm going to say it again. The last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 words are probably unnecessary. And within those last 5 words, there's some which are even more unnecessary. And then, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord, I am God who took you out of the land of Egypt. Which, by the way, is also really interesting. Because when God is introduced as I am God who took you out of the land of Egypt, there are other ways that God could have introduced himself. Like, by the way, this goes back to issues of relationship. How do you define who you are? You know, what is your identity? God could have said, I'm God who created heaven and earth. Which maybe then some of you say, okay, fine, you created heaven and earth. What have you done for us recently, right? What have you done lately, right? Your resume is really old. I want to know what you've done, you know, for us now. And the answer is, well, I took you out of Egypt. It's also very, very important because when he says that I'm God who took you out of Egypt, just realize something, that a whole lot of explanation is within those couple of words. I know you have no idea what I just now said, so let me try to say this now in English. If God would have said, I'm God who created heaven and earth, so essentially God is saying, or for that matter, God could say, I'm the transcendent God who happened to have created heaven and earth, which would be a very God perspective of things. That's who God is. But what does God do? Yeah, what have you done for us lately? God says, I am God who took you out of Egypt. But you realize what else is important within that sentence? God is acknowledging that we were slaves in Egypt instead of saying that I am one who created all of the universe. If I created all of the universe, there's a lot more, quote unquote, leverage in that. I created all of the universe, so therefore I'm in charge. When God says, I'm God who took you out of Egypt, so it could be on the one hand, you owe me, but there's also something else which is there, the flip side of you owe me, which means God also has to acknowledge that we're victims and we've gone through abuse and we've suffered and we have scars and we have pain because all of that's included and we left Egypt. Which means when God says, I'm God who took you out of Egypt, there's an acknowledgement that there's a world which is a corrupt world. There's a world where people do bad things to one another, and there's a world that we're victims, which means this acknowledgement of the Jews as being victims of abuse and being slaves is part of God's introductory words. That gives us so much more leeway, which means God is essentially saying, I know where you're coming from, instead of saying, I'm God who created the universe, and therefore I know what you should be. Which means there's a real big difference in this in the possible introductions which could have taken place over here. One introduction being, or presentation, I'm God who created everything. Okay, fine, you're God who created everything. Okay, what can I possibly say to that? Versus God saying, I'm God who took you out of Egypt, which I'm saying again, there is a dual issue there. One is, okay, what have you done for us lately? You took us out of Egypt. Well, you know, obviously, we owe God something on that point. But then there's the flip side of it. And the flip side of it is this acknowledgement that we live in a very imperfect world, which I think is really also going to be part of the important discussion. Again, I don't know how deep we're going to get to today and how far we're going to get, but part of the important discussion is the Torah intended for people who are perfect, or is the Torah intended for people who are very imperfect? When God says that I'm God who took you out of Egypt, I think there's an acknowledgement over there of the imperfection of the world and the imperfection of humanity. And the Torah is there. It's something which is perfect, but it's there for an imperfect reality. And I think that's really important to us, because maybe sometimes we think that Torah is something beyond us and something which is difficult and something which is impossible, or sets standards which aren't realistic. This presentation that I'm God who took you out of Egypt, I think it's so rich. I think it's so much there, and there's so much understanding over there. Can't you just imagine this collective sigh of relief when God is saying, I know what you've been through, instead of saying, you know, look at me, I'm perfection, and therefore all of you should be perfect. I'm just saying that starting statement over there is really incredibly dramatic and incredibly important, but that's not going to help us completely in the question which I've raised. Because the question which I've raised is, why did we need all of these words as the introduction? I am, right? And Elohim said, all of these things saying, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I'm God who took you out of Egypt, you know, from the house of slavery, you should have no other gods. Okay, that sentence actually makes a lot more sense now. I took you out of slavery, you know, I am all powerful, I was able to do that. Worshipping other gods is an absurdity, and please don't do this, which means you just turn that first Anochi maybe in something which is logical. But let's take a look at the Mechilta, and Rashi's going to quote this. So, I don't know, if you want to look at the Mechilta first or Rashi first, we'll look at the Mechilta, and then we'll look how Rashi incorporates it. Et kol hadverim. So now first I'll realize it's bothered by those words that I said are problematic. What does it mean, et kol hadverim? Milamed, this comes to teach us, sha'amar aseret hadibrot b'dibur echad, that God said all 10 commandments simultaneously. Now, before you ask me, what in the world does that mean? Something which is impossible for a human being to articulate. Shenemar, because it says, Vayidaber Elokim, and God said, Et kol hadrim ha'ele, lemor. God said all of these things. So now that's a really funny interpretation. Because what it just now said to us is that God spoke, and he spoke in a way which is impossible for man to speak, and he said all of the Ten Commandments simultaneously. Now, did anybody understand what the Mechilta just now did? In case you're wondering, look at Rashi in source 3. It's called Rima Eile Melamed Sha'amar Kadosh Baruch Hu Erzeret Adibrot B'dibur Echad. God said all Ten Commandments at once. Mashi'i Evshal Adam Lamarkein. Right now you realize that Rashi just took word for word from this Mechilta. So who understood what the Mechilta just now did for us? Because it did something just now. Did you get what it did? It actually answered our question. Shall I remind you of our question? The question is, what's more important, the content or the very fact that God is speaking? So the Mechilta answered the question and said, what happened at Sinai? At least as the starting point, I'm not saying this is the end point, but at least as the starting point, God spoke in a way which was dramatic and it was impossible to understand. One second, that's really important. Why am I saying it's impossible to understand? Because God said, in a logical way, it's impossible to understand because God said all 10 commandments simultaneously. So we can only say one word at a time. Yes, theoretically, it would be possible to take, you know, today to do a recording and do 10 different tracks, and on your 10 different tracks, you say all 10 commandments at once and say them all simultaneously. Yes, we could probably go and arrange and do such a thing. What would come out of it if we would do that? What would come out would be something which would be impossible to discern. It would be impossible to understand what the content is of what was said, which means go back, and I'm going to be very superficial again now. What we have is the sound of a shofar. What we have is thunder and lightning. And what you have is fire. And suddenly, and out of all this, and by the way, the fire is going to be the same fire as the burning bush. I'm going to say it again. That was a microcosm. This is the macrocosm, which means you're having a sound and light show. And then, very dramatically, the sound of God comes out of heaven and God says something. The only problem is that we have no idea what it was that God said. Because if God said all 10 commandments simultaneously, we had no chance of understanding of it unless there's something else that I'm missing over here. But what I think that the message is, what's more important in terms of what took place? Is it the content or the very fact that God is speaking? And over here, what the Mechilta said and what Rashi incorporated is that it's no question what's more important. What's more important is the very fact that God spoke, even though we couldn't understand it. And by the way, I want to fix that now. Because we couldn't understand it, which means God deliberately spoke in a way that every single person there knew this is not the way a human being could speak. This is not human speak. This is God speak, and this is God speak. Obviously, what's going to happen is that they're going to get somewhat blown away because something phenomenal took place. Keep that in mind now, and hopefully a couple of more things will then fall into place and make more sense. Going back to the Mechilta then, it says, in Kema, Talmud Lomar, no Cheshem Lakecha, lo Yelecha. So what about the content? Elam Lamed, Sha'amar Kadosh Baruch HaSer Tidur Baruch HaD. God said all 10 simultaneously. V'chazar U'perten Dibur Dibur B'nei Atzmo. Then God came back and started explaining each one independently, one at a time. Shomeani af shar kol hadibrot shebetorah nemu kulam b'dibrocha tamal lomar eile. So let's just leave that and go back to Rashi, because that's what Rashi incorporated as well. Shechazar upeiresh al kol dibur v'vnetzmo. So God said all 10 simultaneously, came back then and started breaking them down, and it's at that point that let's read what happens right after the 10 commandments. We're told the following. It's a description in source number 5. First of all, we're going to have an impossible turn of phrase. The Kol Ha'am and all the people, Ro'im, they see. Now, note the word see. The Kol Ha'am Ro'im, they all see. Et HaKolot, they see the sounds. Now, how exactly you see sounds is really quite amazing. Ve'et HaLapidim, what is a lapid? A lapid would be lightning. Okay, you can see lightning. Ve'et kol ha-shofar, which means, continue the metaphor, they see, or the modifier, they see the sound of the shofar. Ve'tahar ashen, and they see the mountain is on fire. Ve'yar ha'am, the people see this. Ve'yanu, and they start to shake. Ve'yamdu mirachok, and they start to move further and further away. So the first thing is, which is completely intriguing, they see sounds, which means they have an outer body experience where the senses sort of flow over one to the other. There is a phenomenon, in order for most of you to achieve this, you would either need to get bit by a really poisonous snake, which can kill you, or there's some really cool drugs you can take also, and it will cause something which is called synesthesia, where your senses flow over from one to another, which means where there are some people who can see sound. That, and it again generally goes together with some kind of a really bizarre genius, but they can hear music in a way which is very, very different from what most of us can do. And as I said, it is generally a cross wiring of the senses, but that's what it's describing as having taken place at Sinai. The people see the sounds, which means sounds, the audible and the visual somehow get confused together. And let's also recognize something that, you know, quote unquote, seeing is believing, but they saw it. It was clear to them. I don't know how to describe this. I don't know how to explain this. I don't know what else to say, which means somehow God is speaking and somehow visually they're able to see this. How? I don't know. But what I do know is it scared the hell out of these people, because it says they started to shake. And not only did they start to shake, they all started to move back. They started to move away because this was simply too frightening. I want to go back to my point about what's important. Is it content or is it revelation? I think the description over here of what takes place at Har Sinai, even though we tend to focus on the Ten Commandments in terms of content, that the experience of receiving the Ten Commandments was one of, not of content, it was one of revelation. It was a theosophy. It was this idea that this something took place which was almost out of body. It was you know what really this could be describing? It's somebody who never experienced prophecy suddenly gets prophecy. And you simply get blown away because you get prophecy. You now see something that you did not know you were able to see, which means you did not know you had that part of your brain that was just able to see certain things, because you can't see things like this, which means you can see things which are physical, you can hear sounds, you can see colors, you can see buildings, you can see trees, but you can't see sound. And now suddenly this gift, as it were, and I'll put it a little differently, that God spoke to them. And that, I think, is what's so important over here in terms of what took place at Sinai, that every single person was there without any question in their mind that was an experience of God speaking. Now, the Talmud goes so far as to say that they actually all died. Why? Because how in the world is your heart supposed to be able to process such a thing? I mean, again, Can you just imagine how fast your heart must be beating and how your breathing must be taking place because you just not got, you had sensory overload and you just experienced something which is impossible to experience. So whether I'm going to say they actually die and then they come back to life and it's experience of resurrection. But by the way, one of the things that is said about Mount Sinai, about, and I'm sorry to say this because I know it's the only thing you're going to remember 10 years from now from the class today, if I say this, and that is that it says that everybody who was sick got healed, and anybody who died just came back to life, and that's the reason why there are so many hospitals called Mount Sinai Hospital, because it's a place that everybody gets healed. Yes, I'm right. In 10 years from now, it's the only thing you're going to remember from today's class, that Mount Sinai hospitals are called that because it was a place of complete healing. But again, I'm going to say the experience that they go through is an experience of this theophany, this idea of God speaking and them completely overwhelmed. They see sounds, and then they say to Moshe the following. Vayomru el Moshe, deberata imanu v'nishma'a. You speak to us, and then we'll be able to hear. So notice, God speaks and they see. Moshe, you speak, and then we'll be able to hear. V'al yidaber imanu elokim, and don't let God speak to us anymore, pen namut. Because if God speaks to us anymore, we are going to die. We can't do this. We can't take this. V'yom Moshe la'am, and Moshe is actually disappointed. Al tirao, don't be afraid. Ki la'avur nasot etchem ba'elokim. God wants to uplift you. He wants the fear of God to be upon you, that you'll be transformed. You're not going to be able to sin. Moshe's plea goes unaccepted. But the people stayed afraid. And Moshe then enters into the mist or the cloud where God is. And it's at this place, Vayomar Shema Moshe, Kol Tamar B'nei Yisrael, tell them, Atem Ra'item, you saw, Ki Min HaShemayim Dibarti Imachem, you saw the sound, you saw that I spoke to you from the mountain, and so on. So just to conclude, you know, this whole section, if I were to ask you, so when we now read about the revelation at Sinai, what was more important, the content or the very fact that God is speaking? It clearly seems to be that the very fact that God is speaking is what people experienced rather than the content, because the content was actually impossible to understand because God spoke simultaneously. And then there was supposed to be a process of breaking it down. Moshe, by the way, for his part, is completely disappointed. He wants the people to stand up and to experience God. Then again, and I think this is really a critical point, Moshe, we know, is the most modest man who ever lived. Moshe may not have thought that what they're about to experience is so dramatic and so special, because he's a man who's experienced prophecy plenty of times by this point. And if he's modest and he's able to do it, then he probably thinks, you know, anybody can do this. And he's generally disappointed. Now, something is going to happen now. A whole bunch of things are going to take place. And I don't know how many of you ever like to live in a world of the what-if world. You know, what if I just did this different? Everything, you know, would change. And it's one of the best ways that we can torture ourselves by, you know, by asking, what if I would have done things a little differently? And I don't think we fully understand the implication of what is taking place right now, because this is going to change everything. And maybe, and I'm going to spell it out for you a little bit. Again, I'm not sure how much you want me to disappoint you or to depress you when I go into this what could have been or what should have been, perhaps. But I think this is an important lesson for us, because the Torah does this occasionally. This is not the only place. The Torah, I don't know if you remember, I don't know if they still do it. You know, they used to, before Netflix, there used to be actually discs, you know, you would watch a movie on a DVD or something, right? Are you too old that you never have seen DVDs? Some DVDs they actually gave different endings of a movie, an alternative ending, which means the director could have shot two different endings of a movie, and then they put as the extra material for this movie, they put this other ending, which is a great way of playing with your mind, right? You know the movie went this, and now they can play with you. Ah, but it could have went like this. And it's, by the way, it's completely brilliant. I think it's a great way to write a book. You write a book with six different endings, and you can completely play with the audience. But how much do we want to really consider what could have been, or should we only stay in the world of what is and what, this is the path we took, and that's it. But I think the Torah occasionally, and again, I can point out these occasions, but today, just this one, occasionally the Torah points out what could have been. And right now, by Mount Sinai, there was an opportunity for things to be different. And I want to start to play through this, again, at least part of what is going to happen. What was supposed to happen next? Which means, what's the next step? God speaks. So when I say what's the next step, the answer is God keeps on speaking. God explains everything, but the people don't want that. The people, that's too intense, that's too much, that's too overwhelming. We can't do that. Which means, on at least one level, God wants to give the Torah to the people, but the people are not really ready to receive the Torah. Maybe I'm going to explain all of this. We need one more piece, and then what I'm saying will make a little bit more sense. Later on, and this is going to be already part of next week, part of Parshat Mishpatim, we have in source number 7, when Moshe is invited to come up for 40 days and 40 nights. V'yomar Hashem Moshe, alei ha'hara, come up to the mountain, v'yeshem, and be there. V'nelecha, I'm going to give you, et luchot ha'evin, I'm going to give you the tablets of stone. V'ha'torah, I'm going to give you the Torah. V'ha'mitzvah, I'll give you the mitzvah. Asher katafti, which I've written, lahoratam, to instruct them thereof. Rashi here in 8 says, V'yomar Hashem Moshe, la'achar matan Torah, that means after the revelation. Alei ha'hara v'yeshem, arba'im yom. Okay, you're going to come up 40 days. I'm going to give you a luchot ha'evin. I'm going to give you v'torah mitzvah asher katavti. And Rashi here says, kol shesh mi'ot u'shlosh asherei mitzvot bichlal aseret ha'dibrot hein. That all 613 commandments are actually within those 10 commandments. So here you need to take a big breath to understand what it is that we were just now told. Let me start like this. One of the things that Judaism teaches is that there's such a thing called Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, the 7 Noahide laws, the 7 commandments that non-Jews have. So did you ever say to yourself, wow, this isn't really fair? We have 613 and they only have 7. What a different world it is. The truth is, the real difference, I'm saying primarily the difference is that we have positive commandments and they tend not to have positive commandments. But if you would really want to do a little bit of homework and a little bit of thinking, take the 7 mitzvot b'nei Noach, figure out what they are, compare them to the 10 commandments, and you'll find out that they're not all that different. There's just a lot of interaction between those 7 and these 10. Now, let's pause again. What do we just now learn from Rashi? We learned that the reality is that these are not 10 commandments. These are 10 chapter headings. And within these 10 chapters are 613 details. Which means, just for example, when it says that you should remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy, it's not just remember the Sabbath day. Not to do any work is all 39 levels of work. It's not just Shabbat, it's also all the holidays. And therefore, what you have within this one dibur, you actually have all of the things having to do with holy days are all really encapsulated within it. When it says not to steal, for example, it's not just like one little technicality in terms of stealing. It's all going to be break into all kinds of things in terms of business attitudes. When it's going to talk about not committing adultery, it's going to be all types of issues involving with sexuality, which means if I look later on in the Torah, how many commandments will fit into each one of these 10 topic headings, you'll come to this realization, what Rashi just now said, that proper understanding of all 10 commandments is the understanding of all 613 commandments. And now things just actually probably got a lot more interesting, which means that God got up and said by Mount Sinai, all 10 commandments simultaneously, which means in reality he said all 613 commandments simultaneously. Did you all realize how I got there just now? Why that wasn't some kind of a leap? Did you all understand that? that God said 10 commandments simultaneously, that's what Rashi said from the Michilta. We just now learned that the 10 commandments actually contain all 613 commandments. If God said all 10 simultaneously, it means he really said all 613 simultaneously, which means essentially what the 10 commandments are is the big picture of Judaism. That's what God gave them once you realize all the details. Now, why would God say it like this? Because it's really important to see the big picture. Let me start this part all over again. There are some Jews who love the little details of Judaism. They get excited by micro considerations of micro points. And again, it's just excitement for them. Yes, you know who some of these people are. There are some Jews who don't get really involved in all the little things, but they like the big pictures of Judaism, the social justice and the caring and the tikkun olam and some things like that. So just realize that Matan Torah had both. First, God shows the big, big picture, and then he wants to break it into the details. We see this big picture, it blows us away, and God wants to explain the details, and then we stop and say, no, talk to Moshe, and then have Moshe come and explain this to us. And Moshe's response is, but if God explains all of this to you, then you'll never sin. But by the way, all that, of course, is true. What sin will they never do? Well, I'll give you one, just an example. I'll give you one sin that they won't do. I'm going to say this on a technical level. They never would have built the golden calf. Why would they never have built the golden calf? Because Moshe never would have gone away for 40 days and 40 nights. Why would Moshe have never gone away? Because Moshe doesn't need to go up and learn the rest of the Torah, because God would have been explaining it to everybody. Which means, what is it that happened when the people say, no, you get it from God and you teach us. God wanted to teach us the Torah and we were afraid to accept it. By the way, that I think is an incredibly important point, which means God wants to give us Torah. And the question is, do we have the guts to be able to take it, or are we too afraid because it's overwhelming and it's frightening? And the people were frightened. The people moved away. And this is too much. By the way, just realize how comical it is. You know, we may die. Moshe, you go do it. One second. Did you follow that? This is too overwhelming. We may die. Moshe, you do it. Are they trying to kill Moshe? It's also very interesting that when the golden calf takes it, we don't know after Moshe. Maybe Moshe died. Well, they just sent him to his death, which is also very funny. But of course, that's not the point. The point is that Moshe thinks the other way around. He thinks, no, you can do this. You can all do this. I mean, later on in the Torah, we're going to find out that other people are prophesying in the camp and someone gets very upset. Yeshua gets upset. Moshe says, I wish everyone would be a prophet. Moshe doesn't think that he is special. Moshe thinks everyone should do this, which means Moshe thinks the world should be perfect. Moshe thinks God should speak to everybody. Moshe thinks that everybody should be on the level to be able to internalize everything that God said. I'm going to say it again now. Moshe says, if you do this, you're not going to sin. You're not going to sin. Why won't they sin? Because they won't be able to sin. Why won't they be able to sin? Again, on a very technical level, they're not going to sin because God is busy speaking to them. How are they going to sin? Which means the golden calf is the unfortunate result of the people encouraging God to speak to Moshe and not to them directly. So therefore, Moshe goes up the mountain and God speaks to him directly. When he speaks to Moshe directly, not to the rest of the people are on their own. The people on their own then get afraid. When they get afraid, they think Moshe must be dead, because it can't possibly be that somebody can really speak to God or have God speak to them. Moshe must be dead. If Moshe must be dead, so therefore we're on our own, and therefore we need to do something else. And realize, quite ironically, that what is it that they do? They go and they do the very thing that God told them not to do. God said, I'm God who took you out of Egypt. Don't make any graven images. So what do? They make a graven image, which is precisely what God just told them not to do. But that's what happens when you see the big picture and you don't see the details. When you see the big picture, Judaism is about tikkun olam. Okay, fine, I accept that. Judaism is tikkun olam. What in the world are all of the small details to create tikkun olam? If you don't understand the details to create tikkun olam, how in the world do you think you're going to create tikkun olam? And by the way, that's the problem in the Jewish world today. I'll say it again. There are some Jews who are hyper-focused on details. They don't see the bigger picture. There are some people who only see the bigger picture, but they don't. There are some people only see the bigger picture, but they don't seem to have an ability to be able to get to the small details, which will then create the very thing which they want to create. So here we are at Mount Sinai. What exactly happened? What happened is we have a revelation. The revelation is overwhelming. It overloads the senses. The people thought they were all going to die. And as I said, there's at least one rabbinic opinion that says they do die. They can't take it, but they see this big picture. They see all the Ten Commandments, not that they hear God's word, they see God's world. All Ten Commandments being said simultaneously. Now we realize all Ten Commandments contain within them the 613 commandments. So they see all of Judaism, and they see all of this incredibly divine picture laid out in front of them. And now God is going to start breaking it down word by word, idea by idea. And that, the details, they can't take. And Moshe says, but if you were to be able to stand up and to take this, you will not be able to sin, because then will then be impossible, because then you will be forced to recognize how the details are connected to the bigger picture, instead of having this fantasy, yes, I love the big picture, but I can do any details I want along the way, and still somehow everything is going to work out. What then happens afterwards? So Moshe goes away for 40 days and 40 nights. While Moshe's away, the people are afraid and the people sin. What sin do they do? They do the golden calf. And now what are the implications of this? So I'm going to explain things now a little bit more, essentially based upon a teaching which one Rabbi Soloveitchik was fond of. He liked this, he shared this, he taught this. Two, it's based upon a teaching of his namesake and his great-grandfather, who was also Rabbi Soloveitchik, both of them the same names, Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. His great-grandfather is known sometimes as the Beit HaLevi, that's the name of the book that he wrote. And Rabbi Soloveitchik quoted this, but I'm going to somehow, you know, combine the way he taught it and the way that it's actually written inside. So what exactly is the implication? So let's add another point. First of all, here's a test. We're testing all your years of Jewish knowledge right now. When Moshe comes down from the mountain, he glows. Was that the first time he came down or the second time he came down? Okay, I'll take your silence as silent begging me to say the answer. But do you have something in your head? Is it the first time he came down he's glowing or the second time? Which means on a logical sense, it's really exactly the same. Which means there's no reason to believe that the experience should have been ever any different. When's the first time he comes down? The first time he comes down, well, the people are sinning. What are they doing? They're making a golden calf. What happens when they make the golden calf? So it says that he takes the luchot and he throws them to the ground. Luchot now are smashed on the ground, but there is a beautiful, horrifying rabbinic teaching that says that when he throws it to the luchot to the ground, well, actually something else happens first. It says as he's carrying the luchot down the mountain, it actually says the other way around. The luchot, maybe they're very heavy, says no, the luchot are carrying Moshe. I don't know, do you like that image? It's not that Moshe's carrying the luchot are carrying Moshe. I mean, maybe sometime in your life, you're doing something which is so uplifting. By the way, you like that word, uplifting. So you get uplifted by what you're doing. And therefore, there's this rabbinic teaching that the luchot are uplifting Moshe. So Moshe's coming down to share it with the people. Again, the first time God tries to speak to the people get blown away. No, we can't do it. Now, Moshe, you do it. Moshe goes up and is about to bring the luchot down. But the people are busy sinning with the golden calf. So Moshe is being uplifted by these luchot, but as they're sinning below, this is the rabbinic teaching. And again, you have to use your imaginations now. And maybe this goes back to seeing sound. That all the letters that were written on the luchot, they start to float back up into heaven. So all the letters start to disappear. And now suddenly Moshe's holding rocks, which are really heavy. So instead of being uplifted by the Torah, by the Aseret HaDibrot, now suddenly everything gets really, really heavy. Now, the luchot themselves, the tablets, are etched in with let's just say with a rock. They're rocks etched in with a hammer and a chisel and so on. So you have the Ten Commandments written on there. What in the world are these letters going up? So let me explain. This is all a rabbinic, Kabbalistic understanding, but I really hope to make sense of it. So give me a couple of seconds, okay? When Moshe goes up the second time, God says, okay, you broke them, now you got to fix them, right? You have to write new ones now. First ones God wrote, the second one Moshe writes. So then here's the rabbinic teaching. It asks, where did Moshe get his glow from? So the answer, which will sound absolutely bizarre, let me look at source 19. It says, Rabbi Yehuda bar Nachman, b'shem Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish Omer, ad she'akotev bekumnus nushtayer kim'a, viviru al rosho, umimenu na'aselo karne ha'od, shenamar umoshe lo yada, ki karan or panav. This is such a bizarre teaching. It says, you know where Moshe's glow came from? It came from the leftover ink in his quill as he was writing down the Torah. But hold it a second. Moshe went up the mountain. And what happened when he went up the mountain? He went up to receive the Ten Commandments. That's etched on stone. What quill? What ink? What writing? What are you talking about? And how this absent-mindedly, the ink touched him, then the ink is radioactive, and Moshe starts to glow, and then you have to start wondering, what in the world is Reish Lakish talking about? So now let me explain, again, it's a little mystical, but the scary part is you may actually understand it now, after everything that we've so far have said. God said 10 commandments simultaneously, which contained all 613 commandments. They actually contained one more thing, and that is they contained the entire oral Torah also. The original 10 commandments contained all of Judaism. And I said it a couple times already, but I didn't spell it out so much. It's everything is there. There's no separation between oral Torah and written Torah. Everything is there. God wanted to give the people everything. But what's going to happen now is they're going to end up being a separation between the two. So what is it that then floats those letters that float up? So now, again, I'm saying the same thing or the same idea, the same metaphor in multiple ways. One, God showed the people the big picture. What was the big picture? Answer, everything. What was the parts of everything that they saw? All 10 commandments, all 613 commandments explained. What does that mean? All 613 commandments explained? The written Torah and the oral Torah. All knowledge is there. That's the way the Kabbalistic sources teach what it was that God said simultaneously. All of Judaism, he said at once as one phenomenal picture. And the people saw it. The people understood it. They saw it, but they didn't understand all the details yet. And at that point, they say, no, stop. We can't take it. That created a possibility of sin. Moshe's right. But because there's going to be sin, all of history is going to be different now. That's what I was saying before, that there was a possibility. It's like this what-if discussion. Well, the what-if, they could have gone a different direction. The what-if created now a world that we went in a way where there will be sin. And of course, our world is a world of sin. That's the world that we live in. We live in a world of temptation. We live in a world of mistakes. We live in a world where damage takes place. And the Torah is given for that. And that was from God's first words. I'm God who took you out of Egypt. I get it. I know. I know that you were slaves. I understand all that. But Moshe is looking at this that, you know, we have this possibility that God will speak and explain to everybody everything. And that possibility existed. The only problem is that it was very unrealistic at that point because we weren't ready for it. We just simply weren't ready for this type of a revelation which would have been so profound, so real. So, I don't know what else to say. Maybe you would say so permanent. There was just so many elements to this. But let me try to explain this now a little differently. When Moshe arrives at Sinai, and he goes up, well, let me start that all over again. When the people arrive at Sinai, there's a possibility for a completely new world. Everything is going to be different and everything is going to be perfect. I don't have to tell all of you, but that's not the way that it ended up working out. The way that it ended up working out is that we ended up with the world who is a world which is full of pain and full of suffering. Okay, now let's stop and I want to put all the details together. God said all of Judaism, written Torah, oral Torah, Kabbalistic Torah, practical Torah, everything he gave to us. It was overwhelming. We just couldn't deal with it. God wanted to now start breaking it down piece by piece. If we would have accepted all of that, the world would have been perfected right then. Right then, you want to use the word the Messiah would have come, the Messianic age. I'll use a better word, perfection at that moment. But we weren't ready for it. I'm not going to say that God didn't know. Of course God knows we're not ready for it, but the possibility existed. At that point, the people move away, which means Shavuot is not the holiday of receiving the Torah, of Kabbalat HaTorah. It's very interesting. How do we refer to that holiday? Chag Matan Torah. God gave us the Torah, but it doesn't say that we accepted it. We were afraid to accept it. Okay. Full stop. Moshe then is invited to come up the mountain, and God gives him 10 commandments. The first 10 commandments was written by God. How does God write? The same way that he speaks. When he speaks, he had everything simultaneously. When he wrote, everything was in those 10 commandments. The same way that when God spoke the 10 commandments, it included all 613 commandments, and everything was there. The original 10 commandments had everything there within them. The 10 commandments, and somehow between the lines, all 613 commandments. What happened then? So I wanted to actually teach you one more midrash, which I think is fascinating. But what happened then? All the people are sinning below, and all the letters start to float up. What letters? Those are the letters that will later on be in the Gemara, that will later on be in the Mishnah, that will later on be in all kinds of Jewish writings. Those letters are the ones which all go back into heaven. And what are we left with? We're left with 10 commandments, just 10 commandments without anything else. The 10 commandments without explanations are too heavy, because how can you explain them? How do you understand them? You can't understand them without the oral Torah. Written Torah without oral Torah just doesn't work. The Ten Commandments without any kind of explanation just get too heavy. And at that point, Moshe either drops them or throws them down. There's one midrash says that drops them. But why do we need a separation between the written Torah and the oral Torah? There's actually a really fascinating midrash. It's said in different ways in at least three different places. I skipped over it before. One place over here is in this Tanchuma, which I think is the best way that it says it. Yeah, in the Midrash in Source 12, it says, Amar lefanav Ribono shel Olam, echtov ota lahem? He goes, should I write all of this for them? He goes, no, Amar lo, eini mevakesh na lemichtav. No, there are certain things I don't want you to write down. Because I know in the future that the other nations, idolaters, are going to control them. And they're going to take the Torah from us. I want to say this clearer the way that it says in the Tetchum. Amal Makadosh Baruch Hu. Right. What's going to happen? Atidin letargema Tetorah. What's going to happen? Vehim omrim anu Yisrael. The non-Jews, by the way, this is Christianity, will say, we're the real Israel. To a very great extent, Islam as well. We're the real Israel. And God will say, well, actually, the Torah has a secret. And the secret is the oral Torah. Do you know the oral Torah? And Amal Makadosh Baruch Hu lumot. Atem omrim shatem banai, you said that you're really my children? Eini yodea elamisha mistarim shali etzlo. Only the ones who know my secrets. Heim banai. Ve'ezo heiza mishna shenitna alpeh v'alkol mimcha ledrosh. He says, no, it's the oral Torah, which this in my mind is fascinating. Because what it's saying is that God gave us the Torah, but we were not willing to accept it all, and we're going to sin. What's going to happen? We're going to sin. So I want to say it much clearer now. When we sin, we're going to go into exile. Let me spell it out in a much clearer way. If at the foot of Mount Sinai we can worship a golden calf, don't you realize that individually and collectively, there's almost no sin that we can't do? We can do every type of sin imaginable if we can sin by the golden calf. By Mount Sinai. That means we're going to sin in the Beit HaMikdash. That means we're going to sin in the land of Israel. That means certainly we're going to sin in other places. We're capable of ignoring holy things, from the holiness of our own individuality, of our souls, to the holiness of the place, to the holiness of other people. We are capable of destroying things which are holy. That's the tragedy. But what does that mean? That means that one day we're going to go into exile. That one day, you know, the day that they worshiped the golden calf and Moshe broke the Luchot, he broke the Ten Commandments, that was the seventh day of Tammuz. That was the day that the walls of Jerusalem were broken. You know, and you say, of course that's the day the walls of Jerusalem were broken. Because if they can worship a golden calf, and by the way, not just worship a golden calf, and they can kill Chor, and they can be guilty of Gilei Arayot, and Shvichot Amim, Avodah Zarah, and every other big sin imaginable, if they can do all of these sins, so yes, they're going to end up, the temple's going to end up being destroyed, and they're going to go into exile. By the way, this is the beautiful part. When we go into the exile, and we go, by the way, think a second about the second exile. Temple's destroyed, we go into exile, the Romans adopt Christianity. Don't you realize how we got back at them? We gave them 2,000 years of guilt. They used to be really happy pagans, and we turned them into Christians with guilt, right? That's the punishment that they got back for having taken. And they say they're the real Israel. So what does God say? I said, I know they're going to go into exile. I know they're going to sin. And they're going to claim that they're the real Israel. That's the separate Torah Shebaal Peh. So now I'm going to go back and say this again. Initially, that first moment of Matan Torah, giving the Torah, sin was not inevitable. It was possible for us as a people to suddenly have the gumption and the bravery and the fortitude to accept the Torah, not just the big picture, all the details. We couldn't do that. Once we didn't do that, that then sets everything off into motion. What's the next thing it sets into motion? It sets into motion this idea that the people will sin. They're going to make a golden calf. Moshe's going to have to go by himself and go get the luchot. He goes and gets the luchot. It has everything in them, but the people are sinning. So then what happens to what will one day be the oral Torah? It goes, floats back up into heaven. Now Moshe has luchot, stones, which are really heavy because there's nothing to support them. He throws it on the ground and so on. He goes up the second time. When he goes up the second time, he's ready to write all of the details that were between the lines, all the 613 commandments. He's ready to write all of the Torah Shebaal Peh. It's in his quill. But God says, no, don't write it, because that has to be between the two of us. Because one day the nations of the world are going to claim that they're the real Israel, and only the ones who have this will be the legitimate Israel. Don't write that down. So what then happens to it? What happens to the ink and the quill? That absent-mindedly, because Moshe doesn't realize, because he is so modest, it becomes a part of Moshe's personality. Now Moshe starts to glow. Why? Because when Moshe is up the second time, God teaches him the entire oral Torah, not by writing it and saying, please present it to them, but rather by teaching it to Moshe. So now that Moshe has taken all of this material inside as a part of him, now we realize that it's learning of the oral Torah which then creates a glow within people. By the way, I can see the difference between all of you, between the beginning of the class and the end of the class, how much all of you glow now, more so than the beginning. Because that's what happens when Jews study Torah. Jews study Torah, then a glow comes and impacts us. It affects us. It becomes a part of who we are. And that's what happened here along the way. Which means, I'm going to go back to that what if question. What if we would have been able to accept everything, the details, and the big picture, the Messianic age would have been here. Sin would have been impossible, because we wouldn't have been able to disconnect the two. We live in a world that people constantly disconnect them. So I'm going to say it one more time. Some hyper-focused on all of the details and other focused upon the big picture, and we need to be able to put the two together. Once we were not able to accept that, and only thing that we got out of Revelation really was the fact that God exists and that God spoke, and therefore this big, beautiful picture, but we missed the details. Missing the details is what creates the possibility for sin. Moshe goes up for 40 days, and what happens? The people down below sin. Moshe comes down holding the first divine luchot that God made that has everything in them, but when the people sin below, then all of the oral Torah floats back into heaven. Those are all of those letters. When Moshe comes down the second time, what has changed now? Now Moshe is glowing. Why is he glowing? So that was this bizarre teaching of Reish Lakish, because of all of the ink that was in the quill that he wanted to write down, but God didn't let him write down, but rather it became a part of Moshe's personality. Now Moshe's become transformed, which means the first time Moshe comes down from the mountain, he's somebody who is simply a delivery guy. He's going to give them the luchot that contain everything in them. Again, first, God wants to give it to us directly. We're not ready to accept it. Then God wants to give it to us via Moshe, but we weren't ready because we were busy sitting. And that's it. The what if. Everything now is different. Now we're going to have a world where Moshe is going to come up another time. He's going to get just 10 commandments. Later on, Moshe will write the other five books of Moshe. He's going to write it when God dictates. But the oral Torah is never going to be written down in that kind of a perfect sense of God dictating it. The oral Torah instead becomes a part of the personality of Moshe Rabbeinu, who then teaches it to us, and then we continue to teach it. You know, our teachers and our parents teaching to us, and then we teach it on to the next generation, and that is a part of who we are. So as a people, who are we? Yes, one, we are a nation and the land of Israel, and that's where we're supposed to go. But how are we supposed to live there based on all kinds of details? Are we a nation or are we a religion? The answer is yes, right? Yes, we are a nation and we're a religion. What happens at Mount Sinai? At Mount Sinai, again, now hopefully we've all come to this understanding. It is much more in terms of the revelation than actually the content. And the content we don't get. And the content we end up being afraid to get. And the content ends up being passed on in a much different way than it could have been passed on. Which means Mount Sinai was a possibility of complete healing and the world being transformed and the world being elevated. But that's part of the message that we need as we move on. It didn't happen. But if we want to create a world which is going to be transformed, if we want to create a world which is going to be elevated, if we want to create this ability in order for perfection to take place, then we have to go back and finally accept the Torah. We have to finally accept the words of God. We have to finally accept the big picture together with the details. And if we do that, then all of us will be able to achieve the glow that Moshe had upon him.